little nice guy who could never do anything like punch his date in the face, even if he was in the house, which obviously he never was. Swear to God, officer, just look at his phone. See all these messages. A lot of domestics try to get smart like that. Take one look at what they've done and start setting up a story. Sometimes it even works. Not on us, but on a jury. Rory Fallon pitched it nicely. Enough messages to show he was really trying to get hold of Aisling. Honest. But nothing after the 8:32 text, so he doesn't come across like a stalker. Again, not rock bottom stupid. Narrows down time of death either way, Steve says. She was texting Lucy at 13 minutes past 7. By 10 past 8 she was down. Either way. That makes me look up from the phone. What? You think these could be legit? Steve does something non-committal with his chin. Probably not. Come on. Someone just happened to walk in looking to kill her at the exact moment when Rory was due to arrive for his beef Wellington. Seriously? I said probably not. Just, we've got a couple of weird things now. I'm keeping an open mind. Oh, Jesus. Little Stevie, bless his heart, is trying to convince us both that we've landed ourselves something special so that our day will brighten up and I'll turn that frown upside down and quit talking about my mate's security firm and we'll all live happily ever after. I can't wait for this case to be over. Let's go pick up Rory Fallon and find out, I say. If we're in luck and the pathetic wimp version of Rory is the right one, he might even spill his guts in time for me to get in a run and some food before I crash out. That gets Steve's attention. You want to go straight for him?
Yeah, why not?
I was thinking the Vic's best friend, Lucy. If she knows anything, it would be good to have her before we start on Rory. Go in there with all the ammo we can get. Which would be the perfect way to work this, if it was a proper murder case, with one of those cunning psychopaths lurking in the shadows, daring us to take our best shot, instead of some gobshite who got his knickers in a twist and threw a tantrum at his girlfriend and who deserves every shortcut we can find. But Steve is giving me the hopeful puppy dog eyes, and I figure, what the hell? He'll have his own burnout soon enough. No point dragging him down into mine. Why not? I say. I lock Aisling's phone and drop it back into its evidence bag. Let's go talk to Lucy Reardon. Steve slams the oven door. The waft of air shoots through the kitchen, charred and rich with meat, about to rot. Sophie is squatting beside the fireplace, swabbing the bloodstain. We're getting out of your hair, I tell her. You find anything we should know about, give us a bell.
Will do. No surprises so far. Your Vic did a pretty serious clean-up for her little dinner date. Practically every surface in here has been wiped. Which is nice. If your guy left prints, we can show they hadn't been there long. So far, we're getting bugger all, though. Looks like you could be right about him having his gloves on. Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, I say. Just so you know, Don Breslin's going to show up any minute. Oh, great. Be still, my beating heart. Sophie drops a swab into a test tube. What do you want him for? The gaffer thinks we could use someone who's good with witnesses. That brings Sophie's head up to look at me. I shrug. Or some shit like that, I don't know. So Breslin's coming in with us on this one. Well, isn't that special? Sophie says. She caps the test tube and starts labelling it. I say, he's just back up. Anything you find comes straight to me or Maureen. If you can't get hold of us, keep trying till you do. Yeah?
One of the reasons it took me and Steve so long to close the Romanian domestic, the reason we're not about to tell O'Kelly, is that when a witness finally got up the guts to ring in, we never heard about the call. It was another 2 weeks before the witness tried again. Fair play to him. A lot of people would have figured forget it. And got me. He said his first call had been put through to a guy, Irish accent, which narrows it down to anyone on the squad except me, who had promised to pass on the message. I don't think it was Breslin, but I'm nowhere near sure enough to bet my case on it. Not a problem. Sophie glances back and forth between her texts. Conway, Moran, or no one. Everyone clear on that? The texts nod. Texts don't give a damn about Dee's and our relationship problems. Most of them think we're a bunch of prima donnas who should try doing some real solid work for a change. But they're loyal as hell to Sophie. Breslin will get nothing out of them. The same for her phone and her laptop, I say. When they get into her email, Facebook, whatever, I want it coming straight to us. Sure. There's this one computer guy who actually listens when people talk. I make sure it goes to him. She drops the test tube into an evidence bag. We'll keep you updated. I take one last look at Aisling on my way out. Sophie's hooked back her hair to take swabs, hoping for DNA from that punch. Death is starting to take over her face, starting to pull her lips back from her teeth, sink hollows under her eyes. Even through that, she hits me with that pulse of memory. Please, I just need please. And me, barely bothering to hide the satisfaction. Sorry, can't help you there. She pissed me off, I say, when I met her before.
Something she did? Steve asks. Something she said?
Don't remember. Something.
Or nothing.
Doesn't take a lot to piss you off when you're in the humour.
Fuck off, you.
I like him, Sophie tells me.
You can keep him.
Half my head is on, where I've seen the Vic before. My guard is down. I duck under the tape. A voice recorder practically takes my eye out and a noise like an attack dog goes off in my face. I leap before I can stop myself, fists coming up, and hear the burst of fake shutter clicks from a phone camera.
Detective Conway, do you have a suspect? Was this a serial killer? Was the victim sexually assaulted?
Most journalists are a good thing. We all have our special relationships. You throw your guy early tip-offs, he leaks whatever you want leaked, and passes you anything you should know. But even with the rest, we usually get on grand. We all know the boundaries. No one oversteps. Everyone's happy. Lewis Crowley is the exception. Crowley is a little snot drip who works for a red top rag called The Courier, which specialises in printing just a few too many details about rape cases for readers who want more buzz of outrage or whatever else they can get off their normal papers. His look is like poet meets pervert, floppy shirts and a dandruffy mac, wavy dark ponytail groomed over a big oily bald spot, and his face is permanently set on righteous offence. I'd rather brush my teeth with a chainsaw than tip off Crowley.
Did the killer stalk his victim? Should women in the area be taking precautions? Our readers deserve to know.
Voice recorder in my face, phone clicking away in his other hand, waft of fell patchouli pomade off his hair. Crowley just about comes up to my nose. I manage not to shoulder the little bollocks in the gob on my way past him. Can't be arsed with the paperwork. Behind me, I hear Steve say cheerily, no comment, no comment on the no comment, no comment on the no comment, on the no comment. The cluster of kids scattering again, open-mouthed, the lace curtains vibrating, the hard chill of the air, after that overheated house. Crowley jerks his voice recorder back just in time before I slam the car door on it. I reverse out into the road without looking behind me.
That little git, Steve says, shaking his jacket sleeves like Crowley dandruffed him.
That was quick, in time for the afternoon edition and all.
Detectives refused to deny stalker rumours. Detectives baffled by possible serial killer. Detectives, no comment on local women's terror. I don't even know where we're going. We don't have Lucy Reardon's address, but I'm driving like we're in a chase. Detectives punch shitty excuse for journalist in the fucking teeth. Over the last few months, Crowley has been turning up at too many of my scenes too fast. We have history. Last year, he was trying to browbeat a quote out of a teenager who'd seen her drug dealer dad take two in the back of the head. I told him if he didn't fuck off, I'd arrest him for hindering my investigation. He flounced off, making offended noises about police brutality and freedom of the press and Nelson Mandela. But it's not like that puts me in a minority. Half the force has told Crowley to fuck off one way or another. There's no reason he should pick me out for revenge, especially not all this time later. And even if his tiny mind had decided to fixate on me, that doesn't explain how he's finding out about my cases as soon as I do. Journalists have ways they don't tell us about, obviously. Crowley probably has a scanner that he tunes to police frequencies when he's on duty and uses to look for couples having phone sex the rest of the time. But still, I have to wonder. You don't make the murder squad without having a world-class gift for finding creative ways to get under someone's skin and wriggle around in there till they'd rip themselves open to get rid of you, without being ready and happy to do it. Even if the witness you're working on is a devastated kid sobbing her heart out for her da. I'm not the exception. Neither is Steve, much as he'd love to think he is. It's not like I was shocked the first time I realised that not all the lads saved that talent for interviews. It gets to feel right on you, like the gun at your hip that leaves you lopsided when it's not there. Some of the lads can't put it down. They use it to get anything they happen to want, or to get past anyone who happens to be in their way, or to break anyone they want broken. Steve is keeping his trap shut, which is a good call. Without noticing, I've got us deep into Phoenix Park. Probably because it's the only place around where I can drive without getting snarled up in traffic and idiots. The roads are straight, between wide gentle meadows and rows of huge old trees, and I'm going like the clappers. The cadet is about ready to have a fit of the vapours. I slow down, pull over, nice and neat, signalling well in advance and keeping one eye on my rearview mirror. We need Lucy Reardon's address, I say. I've got her mobile number. We pull out our phones. Steve dials his contact at one of the mobile networks and hits speaker. We listen to the even buzz of the ring. Deer watch us from under bare spreading branches. I realise I'm still wearing my shoe covers. I'm lucky they didn't slide in the pedals and crash the car. I take them off and toss them in the back seat. The sunlight is still thin and warmthless. It still feels like dawn. Chapter 2. Steve's contact gives us a home address for Lucy Reardon in Rathmines, a work address at the Tort Theatre in town, and a birth date that makes her 26.
Just gone 9:30, Steve says, checking his watch. She should be home.
I'm dialing my voicemail. I've got a new message, and I just can't wait to hear it. She'll be sleeping off last night, like anyone with sense, this time on a Sunday morning. The park is making me edgy. Outside the car windows, the sky is dead. Not one bird,
and the massive trees feel like they're slowly tilting inwards over us. You head up the interview. Seeing as I don't have a legit reason to arrest Crowley or punch him in the mouth, or to tell the gaffer where to shove his domestics, I'm going to take the head off the first person who gives me half an excuse. And I don't want it to be our key witness. I didn't used to be like this. I've always had a temper on me, but I've always kept it under control, no matter how hard I had to bite down. Even when I was a kid, I knew how to hold it, load it and cocked while I got my target in range, lined up my sights and picked my moment to blow the bastard away. Since I made murder, that's been changing. Slowly. I never lose a lot of ground at once, but I never gain any back. And it's starting to show. The last few months, I've lost count of how many times I've caught myself in the half second before I splattered temper everywhere and stuck myself cleaning up the mess for the rest of my life. I wasn't kidding about telling that witness he was too stupid to live. My mouth was opening to do it when Steve came in with some soothing question. I know, dead certain, that someday soon, neither of us is going to catch me in time. And I know, dead certain, that the rest of the squad is going to be on that moment like sharks on chum. It'll be blown up to 10 times life size and spread all round the force like it's a full frontal shot of me naked. And every day, for the rest of my career, someone will slap me in the face with it. Murder isn't like other squads. When it's working right, it would take your breath away. It's precision cut and savage, lithe and momentous. It's a big cat leaping full stretch, or a beauty of a rifle so smooth it practically fires itself. When I was a floater in the general unit, fresh out of uniform, a bunch of us got brought in to do the scut work on a murder case, typing and door to door. I took one look at the squad in action, and I couldn't stop looking. That's the nearest I've ever been to falling in love. By the time I made it onto the squad, something had changed. The pressure level means murder is balanced so finely that it only takes a few new heads to shift the whole feel of the squad. Turn that big cat rogue and edgy. Set that rifle warping towards its moment to blow up in your face. I came in at the wrong time, and I got off on the wrong foot. Part of it was not having a dick, which apparently is the main thing you need to investigate murders. There's been women on the squad before, maybe half a dozen of them over the years. Whether they jumped or got pushed, I don't know. But by the time I got there, none of them were still around. Some of the guys figure that's the natural order. They thought I had some cheek, swanning in like I had a right to be there, and I needed to be taught a lesson. Not all of them. Most were fine, at least to start with. But enough. They tested me, my first weeks on the squad. The same way a predator tests a potential victim in a bar, tossing out small stuff, worn out jokes starting, why is a woman like a... comments about me being on the rag, hints about how I had to be pretty good at whatever I'd done to get this gig, to see if I'd force myself to laugh along, checking, just like the predator checks, for the well-behaved one who'll take the put-downs and the humiliation sooner than, God forbid, make a fuss, who can be forced, shove by shove, into doing whatever he wants. Deep down, though, it wasn't about me being a woman. That was just their in. That was just the thing they thought would or should make it easy for them to push me around. Deep down, this was simpler. This was about the exact same thing as primary school.
when Ireland was still lily white and I was the only brownish kid around, and my first ever nickname was Shiteface.
It was about the same thing as everything else humans have done to each other since before history began. Power.
It was about deciding who would be the alpha dogs and who would be at the bottom of the pile. I went in expecting that.
Every squad hazes a newbie.
My first day on missing persons, they tried to send me door to door asking if anyone had seen Mike Hunt. And murder was already growing a rep for doing it that bit harder. Fewer laughs, more edge. But just because I expected it, that didn't mean I was going to take it. If I learned one thing in school, it's this. You never let them get you on the bottom of the pile. And if you do, you might never get up again. I could have followed official policy and reported to my superintendent that I felt other officers were discriminating against me and creating a hostile workplace environment. Apart from the obvious, that would have been the perfect way to make things worse. I'd rather shoot my own fingers off than go running to the gaffer whining for help. So when this little shiteball called Roach slapped my arse, I nearly broke his wrist. He couldn't pick up a coffee cup without wincing for days. And the message went out loud and clear. I wasn't going to roll over, belly up and wiggling and panting for whatever the big dogs wanted to do to me. So they went shoulder to shoulder and started pushing me out of the pack. Subtle stuff at first. Somehow everyone knew about my cousin who was in for dealing smack. Fingerprint results never made it to me, so I never found out about the link between my case and a whole string of burglaries. One time, I raised my voice at a lying alibi witness, nothing major, no worse than everyone else does all the time. But someone must have been watching behind the one-way glass, because it was months before I could interview a witness without the squad room wanting to know, just slagging, all a great big laugh. "Did you shout it out of him, Conway? Bet you I had him shite in his cacks. Is he going to get compensation for the hearing loss? The poor bastard'll think twice before he agrees to talk to the cops again, won't he?" By this time, even the guys who'd been grand were smelling the blood in the air around me, pulling back from trouble. Every time I walked into the squad room, I walked into a thud of instant, total silence. Back then, at least I had Costello. Costello was the oldest inhabitant. It was his job to show newbies the ropes, and he was sound. No one was going to turn it up too high while Costello had his eye on me. A few months later, Costello retired. In school, I had my mates. Anyone who messed with me was messing with them too, and none of us was the type you wanted to mess with. When a rumour went round that my dad was in prison for hijacking a plane, and half the class wouldn't sit next to me in case I had a bomb, we tracked down the three bitches who had started it and beat the shite out of them. And that was the end of that. In murder, once Costello went and until Steve came on board, I was all on my own. Before the door closed behind Costello, the lads stepped it up. I left my email open on my computer, came back to everything wiped. Inbox, sent box, contacts, gone. Some of them refused to switch into interviews with me when it was time to shake things up. "Well, you're not sticking me with her. I'm not taking the blame when she fucks up." Or they needed every warm body for a big search except mine, and sniggered, "Couldn't track an elephant through snow." Just too loud on their way out the door. At the Christmas party, where I knew better than to have more than one pint, someone got a phone snap of me with my eyes half shut. It was on the notice board the next morning, labelled "Alco Cop." By the end of the day, everyone knew I had a drink problem. By the end of the week, everyone knew I had got rat arse drunk, puked on my shoes and given someone, the name varied, a blowjob in the jacks. No way for me to know which one of the lads was behind it, or which two, or 5 or 10. Even if I stick it out in the force till retirement, there'll still be people who believe all that shite.
As a rule, I don't give a fuck who thinks what about me. But when I can't do my job because nobody trusts me enough to go near me, then I start caring. All of which is why Steve was the one ringing his contact for Lucy Reardon's info. You pick up useful piles along the way, for moments when an official request would take too long. And a few months back, I was making nice with this kid who worked for Vodafone, until one day I rang him to find out who owned a mobile number. And he stammered and dodged and tied himself in knots and couldn't get off the phone fast enough. I didn't bother asking for explanations. I already knew. Not the details, like who had got onto him or what they had threatened him with, but enough. So Steve rings the mobile companies when we need info, and Steve runs interviews when I'm too worried to trust myself. And I keep telling myself those fuckers will never get to me. My voicemail message is from Breslin. Of course, lucky me. Conway, hi. Breslin has a good voice, deep, smooth. The newsreader accent that tells you mummy and daddy forked out for school fees to make sure he wouldn't have to meet people like me and Steve. And does he know it? I think he fantasizes about doing movie trailer voiceovers that start, in a world. Good to be working with you guys. We need to touch base as soon as possible. Give me a bell when you get this. I'll head down to the crime scene, take a quick look, see at what we've got. If we don't cross paths there, I assume we'll have talked by the time I'm done. We'll take it from there. Click. Steve shoots me finger guns and a wink. Yeah, baby. Touch my base. I snort before I can stop myself. You know what it feels like? It feels like he's sticking his tongue right out of the phone down your ear. And he's positive it just made your day. We're snickering like a pair of kids. Breslin brings it out in us. He takes himself so seriously, you're never going to live up to it. So we don't try. Because before he rang you, he spritzed the good eau de cologne on his magic tongue just for you. Oh, I feel all special now, Steve says, hand on heart. Don't you feel special? I feel like I should have brought my ear loop, I say. What'll keep him out of our hair for another while? Incident room? Which isn't a bad idea all round. Someone needs to nab us an incident room and Breslin will get one of the good ones with an actual whiteboard and enough phone lines, while me and Steve would get dumped with the two-desk shithole that used to be the locker room and still smells like it. But nothing's going to keep him away for long. In fairness, the interviews are why the gaffer has him on board. He's going to want to be there for them. Don't be giving me in fairness. I'm not in the humour to be fair to bloody Breslin. Actually, I'm in a better mood. I needed that laugh. Incident room is good. We'll go with that. Don't be biting his head off, Steve warns me. I'm not going to bite his head off. Why shouldn't I bite his head off if I feel like it? Breslin isn't one of the worst by a long shot. Mostly he ignores the pair of us. But that doesn't mean I have to like him. Because we're stuck with him. Because that'll be a lot harder if he's in a fowler with us from the start. You can smooth him down. Stick your tongue in his ear. I ring Breslin's voicemail again. If I have to do a Breslin, phone tag is the ideal way to do it. And leave him a message back. Breslin, Conway here. Looking forward to working with you. I shoot Steve an eyebrow. See? I can do nice. We're going to pick up the guy who was due at the Vic's house for dinner and bring him back to base for the interview. Could you meet us there? We'd really value your angle on this one. Steve mimes a blowjob. I give him the finger. On the way to his place, we're going to have a quick chat with the Vic's best friend in case there's anything we should know. Can you use that time to set us up with an instant room since you'll be heading back to the squad anyway? Thanks. See you there. I hang up. See? I say to Steve, that was gorgeous. If you'd put in a kiss at the end, it would have been perfect. Funny guy. I want to get going. The bare trees feel lower, closer. Like while I was focusing on Breslin, they grabbed their chance to move in around us. Let's find out what kind of crap floaters they dumped on us. Steve is already dialing. Bernadette, the admin, gives him numbers for our floaters. 6 of them. O'Kelly pulled out all the stops there. A couple of them are good guys. Useful. At least one isn't. If we want more, we're going to have to fill out requests in triplicate. Explain why we can't do our own dirty work. And generally sit up and beg like a pair of poodles. Later on, we'll have the first case meeting. Me and Steve and Breslin and all the floaters in the instant room. Everyone taking notes while I give a rundown of the case and we assign jobs. There's stuff that needs doing fast, though. No time to wait. Steve sends 2 of our lucky floaters to do a preliminary door-to-door in Viking Gardens. Find out what everyone knows about Ashley and Murray and what they saw and heard last night. And another 2 to pull all the local CCTV footage they can get before anyone records over it. Meanwhile, I send the last 2 off to get Rory Fallon's address, find out if he's home, sit on the house if he is, track him if he goes anywhere, and try to be discreet about the whole thing. They could just bring him in straight away, but my plans don't include Breslin spotting him in the corridors and deciding to do me and Steve a favour by getting a confession before we even make it back to the squad. Breslin rings me back. I let it go to voicemail. The chewed up night shift look on Steve gives me some idea what I look like. So before we head for Lucy Reardon's place, we do a fast reboot. Brush wrinkles out of our jackets and night food crumbs off our shirts. Steve combs his hair. I take down what's left of my bun and pull it back smooth and tight again. I don't do makeup on the job, but the slice of me in the rearview mirror seems decent enough. On a good day, I look good. And on a bad day, you'd still notice me. I take after my dad, or I assume I do. I got the height from my ma, but not the thick, shiny black hair, or the cheekbones, or the skin that's never going to need fake tan. I wear good suits, stuff that's cut right and works with my shape, long and strong. And anyone who thinks I should be schlepping around in a sack to protect him from his own bad thoughts can fuck himself. The stuff people think I should try to hide, being tall, being a woman, being half whatever, is the stuff I keep up front and in their faces. If they can't handle it, I can use that. Yeah, Steve says, pointing at himself. He looks like his mammy spit-shined him for mass, but he plays that up on purpose. You use what you've got, and what Steve's got is that your parents would be delighted if you brought him home. Have to do, I say, readjusting the mirror. Let's go. I hit the pedal hard and let the cadet pretend it's a real car while it gets us out of there. I get a sudden nasty feeling like the trees behind us have snapped together and come down. With a silent roar and a smash of branches onto the spot where we were parked. Lucy Reardon lives in one of those tall, old terrace houses split into flats. A lot of those are shitholes, but hers looks okay. The front garden's been weeded, the window frames have been painted in the last decade, and there are 6 bells by the door instead of a dozen, meaning the landlord isn't jamming people into 9-foot square bedsits and making them all share a jacks. It takes 2 rings before Lucy answers the intercom, in a voice coated with sleep. "Hello?" Steve says. "Lucy Reardon?" "Who's this?" "Detective Garda Stephen Moran. Could we have a word?" A long second, then Lucy says, and the sleep's fallen off her voice, "I'll be down in a minute." She opens the door fast and wide awake. She's short and fit, the kind of fit you get from life, not from the gym. She wears it like it's owned, not rented. Cropped, platinum hair with a long sweep of fringe falling in her face. Pale face with clean, quick features. Smudges of last night's mascara. She's wearing a black hoodie, paint-splashed black combats, nothing on her feet, a lot of silver ear jewellery, and what looks to me like a fair-sized hangover. She has bugger all in common with Aisling Murray, or with what I was expecting. We have our IDs out and ready. "I'm Detective Garda Stephen Moran," Steve says, "and this is my partner, Detective Garda Antoinette Conway." And he pauses. You always leave a gap there. Lucy doesn't even look at the IDs. She says sharp, "Is it Aisling?" Which is why you leave the gap. It's unbelievable what people will spill into it. Steve says, "Could we come in for a few minutes?" She looks at the IDs then, takes her time checking them out or making some decision. Then, "Yeah," she says, "okay, come in." And she turns and heads up the stairs. Her flat is on the first floor, and I was right. It's decent. A small sitting room with a kitchenette to one side and two doors leading off the others for the bedroom and the jacks. She had people over last night. Empty cans on the coffee table and under it. Thick layer of smoke in the air. But even before that, this place was nothing like Aisling's. The curtains are made out of old postcards sewn together with twine. The furniture is a banged up wooden coffee table and a couple of lopsided sofas covered in Mexican looking woven throws. And there are four 1970s phones and a stuffed fox on top of a coil of cable beside the telly. Nobody ordered this place through an app. Me and Steve go for the sofa with its back to the high sash window, leaving Lucy with the limp excuse for daylight hitting her face. I get out my notebook, but I sit forward, letting Steve know that I'm not going to be sitting this one out altogether. Kelly was full of shite. Steve is great with witnesses. Not as flashy with it as Breslin, but he can make just about anyone believe he's on their side. But I used to be pretty good too. Not all that long ago. And Lucy doesn't seem like she's going to piss me off. This girl is no idiot. "Anyone else home?" Steve asks. After this conversation, Lucy is going to want backup. Lucy sits down on the other sofa and tries to look at both of us at once. "No, it's just me." "Why?" Your basic witness face is a mix of eager to help, dying to know the story, and, oh God, I hope I'm not in trouble. Your standard variation in neighbourhoods where we're not popular is a sullen teen-style slouch stare, including from people who are decades too old to pull off that shite. Lucy isn't wearing either of those. She's sitting up straight, feet planted like she's ready to leap into action, and her eyes are too wide open. Lucy is scared, and she's wary, and whatever she's wary about is taking all her focus. There's a green glass ashtray on the coffee table that she should have emptied before she let cops in. Me and Steve pretend we don't see it. "I'll just confirm a couple of things," Steve says, easily giving her his best non-threatening smile. "You're Lucy Reardon, born the 12th of April, 88, and you work at the Torch Theatre. That's all correct, yeah?" Lucy's back is stiffening up. Nobody likes us knowing stuff they haven't told us, but she's liking it even less than most. "Yeah, I'm the technical manager." "And your friends were Aisling Murray?" "Close friends. We've known each other since we were kids." "What's happened?" I say, "Aisling's dead." Which isn't me being tactless. After the way she opened the door, I want her reaction neat. Lucy stares at me. So many expressions collide on her face that I can't read any of them. She's not breathing. I say, not bitchily, "Sorry to start your day off like this." Lucy grabs for a pack of Marlboro Lights on the coffee table and reefs one out without asking permission. Even her hands look active. Strong wrists, short nails, scrapes and calluses. For a second, the lighter flame jumps and wavers. Then she gets it under control and draws hard on the smoke. She asks,
"How?"
Her head is down, that white blonde streak hiding her face. I say, "We don't have any definitive answers yet, but we're treating the death as suspicious."
"That means someone killed her, right?"
"Looks like it, yeah."
"Shit,"
Lucy says low. I'm pretty sure she doesn't know she's saying it.
"Oh, shit. Oh, shit."
Steve says, "Why did you assume we were here about Aisling?" Lucy's head comes up. She's not crying, which is a relief, but her face is a nasty white. Her eyes look like she's having trouble seeing, or trouble not getting sick. She says,
"What?"
"When you came to the door, you said, 'Is it Aisling?' Why would you think that?" The cigarette's shaking. Lucy stares at it, curls her fingers tighter to keep it still.
"I don't know. I just did."
"Think back. There has to have been a reason."
"I don't remember. That's just what came into my head."
We wait. In the walls, pipes hoot and groan. Upstairs, a guy yells something about hot water and someone gallops across the floor, making the postcard curtains tremble. Next to Lucy on the sofa is a Homer Simpson stuffed toy with a rolly paper that says "Princess Buttercup" stuck to its forehead. "Last night was a good one." Next time Lucy sees that toy, she's going to shove it to the bottom of her bin. After a long minute, the line of Lucy's spine resets. She's not going to cry or puke. Not now, anyway. She's got other things to do. I'm pretty sure she's just decided to lie to us. She taps ash without even clocking the spliff butts in the ashtray. She says, carefully, feeling her way, "Aisling just started seeing this guy Rory. Last night she was cooking him dinner. It was his first time in her house. They'd only met in public places before, so when you said you were guards, that's the only thing I could think of. Something went wrong there. I mean, I couldn't think of any other reason you'd want to talk to me." "Bullshit. Just off the top of my head, I can think of half a dozen reasons. The hash, noise complaints from the neighbours, street fight outside and we need witnesses, domestic in another flat, ditto. I could keep going, and Lucy's well able to do the same. Here it is, the lie."
"Yeah," I say. "About that, yesterday evening you and Aisling were texting about her dinner date."
The wariness goes up a notch as Lucy tries to remember what she said.
"You told Aisling to..."
I pretend to check my notebook.
"Be careful, okay?"
"Why was that?"
"Like I said, she hadn't known him that long and she was going to be on her own in the house with him."
Steve is doing puzzled.
"Is that not a bit paranoid, no?"
Lucy's eyebrows shoot up and she stares at Steve like he's the enemy.
"You think?"
"I wasn't telling her to have a loaded gun in her bra. Just to mind herself with a strange guy in her house. That's paranoid."
"Sounds like basic good sense to me," I say.
Lucy turns to me gratefully, relaxing back off the attack.
"I'd tell my mate the same thing."
"Had you met Rory?"
"Yeah, I was actually there when the two of them met. This guy I know from work, Lar, he published a book about the history of Dublin theatres, and the launch was at the bookshop Rory runs, the Wayward Bookshop in Ranelagh. A bunch of us went from the Torch and I talked Aisling into coming along. I thought she needed a night out."
Which is more info than I asked for. It's the oldest technique in the book. Get the witness pissed off with one of you, She'll give the other one extra. And me and Steve do it a lot, but mostly we do it the other way round. I let Steve take the notes while I enjoy the feeling of being the good cop for the first time in a long time.
And Aisling and Rory clicked, I say.
Big time. Lar had read a bit out of the book and he was signing copies, and the rest of us were hanging around drinking the free wine, and Aisling and Rory got talking. They basically vanished into a corner together. Not snogging or anything, just talking and having a laugh. I think Rory would have stayed there all night, but Ash has this rule about not talking to a guy for too long. Lucy cuts off, blinking. It's that filter. God forbid we should think bad things about poor sweet Ash. But I know what she's on about. The rules. In case the guy guesses she's into him, I say, nodding like this makes total sense. Yeah, exactly. I don't know, that's a bad thing for some reason. A twist of Lucy's shoulder and her mouth, but it's affectionate, not bitchy. So after maybe an hour, Ash came dashing over to me and she was all, oh my God, he's so sweet and so funny and so interesting and so lovely. That was so much fun. She said she'd given him her number and now she had to find someone else to talk to. So she stuck with me and the gang from work, but she spent the whole rest of the night going, is he looking over? What's he doing now? Is he looking at me? Which she always was. They were both totally smitten. Lar who? I say. And when was the book launch? Lar Flannery? Lawrence? It was at the beginning of December. I don't remember the exact date. A Sunday night, so theatre people could come. Did you meet Rory again after that? No. That was it. Aisling's only seen him a few times. She was taking it slow. Lucy's head ducks to her cigarette. A long pull. We've just brushed past whatever she's hiding. We leave a silence. But this time she drops nothing into it. Instead, she asks,
are you? I mean, do you think Rory was the one who...
The question's natural enough. But all of a sudden her voice is full up and leaping with things I can't catch, and the flash of her eyes under her fringe is too fast and too intent. This means more to her, or means something more urgent than it should. Steve says, what do you think? Would he be your guess?
I don't have a guess. You're the detectives. Is he your prime suspect or whatever you call it?
Was there anything specific about Rory that set off your radar? I ask. Made him seem like someone to be careful of.
Lucy's twitching to ask again, but she knows better. Smart, capable, and used to thinking on her feet. Whatever she's keeping back, we'll be lucky to get to it. She takes another drag of her smoke.
No.
Nothing. He seemed like a nice guy. Kind of boring, I thought. Anyway, but Ash was obviously seeing something I missed, so...
She ever say anything indicating that he frightened her?
Pressured her? Tried to control her? Lucy's shaking her head.
No, seriously, nothing like that, ever. It was always how lovely he was and how relaxed she was around him. And how she couldn't wait to see him again.
Are you thinking?
I say, then I've got to be straight with you, Lucy. It doesn't make sense that you were this worried about Aisling. Texting her to be careful, yeah?
Sure, I can see that.
But taking one look at us and figuring we had to be here about her? When you just told me Rory seemed like a good guy, no threat.
Nah.
When we showed up, you should have been wondering if the guy downstairs was dealing, or if someone got stabbed outside last night, or if one of your family was mugged or hit by a car. There's no way your mind should have gone straight to Aisling. unless there's something about her that you're not telling us. Lucy's smoke is right down to the butt. She grinds it out in the ashtray, taking her time. But she's not stonewalling. She's deciding. The light through the window is filling out. It's ruthless on her, scraping away what should be offbeat pretty, turning her to nothing but eye bags and mascara smudges on white. She says,
"Is it okay if I get a glass of water? My head's killing me."
"No problem," I say. "We're in no hurry." She takes her time running the tap in the kitchenette, her back to us, cups water in her hands and ducks her face into them, stays there while her shoulders lift and fall once. She comes back holding a pint glass in one hand, wiping water off her face with the other wrist and looking a couple of notches more alive. When she sits down, she says,
"Okay, I think Ash might have been seeing someone else, as well as Rory."
That flash of her eyes again, checking her reactions, too ferociously intent. Me and Steve don't look at each other, but you can feel your thoughts click together like glances. Steve thinking, "I knew it. I knew something was weird here." Me thinking, "Not a fucking chance I'm going to get my run today." Steve says, "What was his name?"
"I don't know. She never said."
"Not even a first name?" Lucy's shaking her head hard enough that her fringe falls forward. She shoves it back again.
"No, she never even actually said she was seeing anyone else. It's just a feeling I got. I don't know anything specific, okay?"
"Okay," I say. "Fair enough. What gave you that feeling?"
"Just stuff. Like, the last few months, way before Ash met Rory, I'd ask if she wanted to meet up for a drink, and she'd say no, she couldn't, but without any reason why not. And normally she'd have been like, 'Can't, I've got Pilates,' or whatever. Or she'd say yes, and then at the last minute she'd text me like, 'Change of plans, can we do it tomorrow instead?' She was around a lot less, mainly. And she got her hair done a lot more, and her nails. They were always perfect. And when someone's around less and gets more high maintenance..."
Lucy shrugs.
"Mostly it's a new relationship."
Aisling cancelling her restaurant date with Rory with just a few hours to go. I thought she was showing him who was boss. I feel it again, that faint pulse that caught at me in Aisling's kitchen when Steve showed me the cooker. A pulse like hunger, like dance music, something good, away in the horizon, tugging. I can feel the beat of it hitting Steve's blood too. He says, "How long ago did this start?" Lucy draws tight lines in the condensation on her glass and has a think, either about the actual answer or about the one she wants to give us. "Maybe 5 or 6 months ago, towards the end of summer." "Any idea where they might have met? Work? Pub? Hobby?"
"Haven't a clue."
"Who else did Aisling hang out with besides you?" Lucy shrugs.
"She went for a drink with people from work sometimes. She doesn't have a lot of friends."
"What about hobbies? She have any?"
"Not serious ones. She's been doing a bunch of evening classes the last couple of years. She did salsa for a while, and then some image and styling thing, and she learned a bit of Spanish. Last summer, I think she was doing cooking. She liked the people, but she never talked about any guy in particular. There was never anyone she mentioned that bit too often. Nothing like that."
Aisling Murray is sounding like more and more of a laugh riot. I say, "I've got to tell you, Lucy. This is coming across pretty weird to me. You and Ash, you were best friends since you were kids, but she tells you nothing about her fella. Her eyes come up wary. I said we've been friends since we were kids. I didn't say we were best friends.
No? Then what were you?
Friends. We hung out in school. We stayed in touch when we grew up. We didn't have a Vulcan mind melt. Steve has this lovely mix of worried and reproachful growing on his face. He says, you know how we got your name. Ashleen had you down as her emergency contact. When you're picking that, you pick someone who you think cares about you. Lucy's head jerks away from the reproachful frown. Her mum died a few years back. Her dad's not around. She's an only kid. Who else was she going to put? Lying again. For some reason, she's trying to make the friendship sound like a leftover stuck to her shoe. But the layer of warmth when she talked about Ashleen's idiot rules said different. I say, you're also the person Ashleen texted and rang most often. And like you said, she didn't have a lot of mates. She thought of you as her closest friend, all right. Did she know you didn't feel the same way? We are friends. I said that. I'm just saying we don't live in each other's pocket. We don't know everything about each other's life, okay? So who would know all about Ashleen's life? Who was her best friend if it wasn't you? She didn't have one, not like you mean. Some people don't. Her voice is pulling tighter. I leave it. She's holding herself together by her fingernails. And I don't want her going to pieces on us right now. Regardless, I say. Me, when I'm going out with someone, I tell my friends, even if they're not my best bosom buddies. Don't you? Lucy takes a gulp of her water and gets herself back. Yeah, sure, but Ashleen didn't. You said she was dying to talk to you about Rory, how great he was. Did she tell you about other boyfriends before him? Introduce them to you? Yeah, I mean, it's been a few years since she went out with anyone, but yeah, I met him. She wanted to talk about him, see what you thought of him, all that, right? Yeah, but not this time. No, not this time. Steve asks, why did you figure that was? Lucy rubs her water glass over a smear of purple paint on the knee of her combats, scrapes at it with a fingernail. She says, I figured the guy was married, wouldn't you? She's looking at me. I say, that'd be my first thought, all right. Did you ask her? I didn't want to know. As far as I'm concerned, anyone who's taken is well off limits. And Ash knows that. Neither one of us wanted to have the conversation. It would only have turned into a fight. You're saying she might have been okay with seeing a married guy, though. They weren't off limits to her. Purple paint flakes away. Lucy rubs it to a smudge between her fingertips. That makes her sound like some homewrecker vamp manhunter. She's not like that. At all. She's really unsure of a lot of stuff. Does that make sense? A quick glance up at me. I nod. Her face looks older than it did when we got here, dragged down around the edges. This conversation is taking a lot out of her. And if the other person's totally sure, a lot of the time she ends up thinking they're probably right. So, yeah, I could see her hooking up with a married guy. Not because she thought it was okay or because she didn't care, but because he convinced her that it might not be not okay. Gotcha, I say, I'm glad Aisling is the vic and Lucy is the witness here, not the other way round. By this point, I would have brained Aisling with something gingham.
So, you must have been well pleased when she hit it off with Rory, Steve says.
Nice, single guy. Nothing to cause tension between the two of you. Nothing to cause Aisling hassle. Yeah?
Yeah.
But there's a fraction of a second before it. Another brush past something Lucy isn't telling us. I say, did you get the sense she'd finished it with the other fella before she started seeing Rory? Or would you guess she had them both on the go?
How would I know? Like I said,
was she still being vague about her social plans? Still cancelling on you at the last minute?
I guess, yeah, she was.
I say, so that's why you were worried about Aisling. Lucy's still messing around with paint smears, elbows on her thighs and her head right down.
Anyone would be. I mean, juggling two guys. One of them's married.
That's not going to end well.
And Ash, she's really naive. In a lot of ways. It wouldn't occur to her that this was a pretty volatile situation. I just wanted her to be aware of that.
This is making more sense, but not enough.
You said Rory didn't set off your alarm bells, I say. What about this other guy?
I don't know anything about him to set off alarm bells. Like I said, I just didn't like the whole setup. She's tensing, digging her elbows into her thighs. Whatever we're circling, she's not happy being this close to it. I'm not happy myself. Lucy is no idiot. She should know this isn't the time to fuck about. I say,
that still doesn't explain why your mind went straight to Aisling when we showed up at your door.
You want to try again? The edge on my voice makes her elbows dig in harder.
That's why. Because what else was it going to be?
Maybe I lead a really boring life, but most people I know don't do anything that could land actual detectives on my doorstep. I'm less and less in the mood for bullshit.
Right, I say.
I lean over and give the ashtray a shove so it slides towards Lucy. A little puff of rancid ash rising into the light. Like I said, try again. Lucy's head comes up. And she gives me a whole new kind of wary look. Steve shifts his weight beside me. I know that shift.
Leave it.
I consider punching my elbow through his ribs, but the fact is, he's right. I've been getting on well with Lucy, and I'm about to throw that away for good. I say, more gently, we're not planning on doing anything about that. We're only interested in Aisling. The wary look fades, but not all the way. Steve, right back in the good cop seat where he's happiest, says,
tell us a bit about her. How did you meet?
Lucy lights another smoke. I love nicotine. It puts witnesses back in their comfort zone when things get tricky. It keeps the Vic's friends and family from going to pieces. It means we can make suspects as antsy as we want and then throw them an instant chill pill when we want them calm again. Non-smokers are double the hassle. You have to find other ways to adjust their dials. If it was my call, everyone involved in murders would be on a pack a day. She says,
when we started secondary school, so when we were 12.
You're from the same place, yeah? Where's that?
Greystones,
just outside Dublin. Smallish town, but big enough that Lucy and Aisling were hanging out together by choice, not because there was no one else. Steve asks, and what was Aisling like back then? If you had to describe her in one word, what would you pick? Lucy thinks back. That affection warms her face again.
Shy, really shy.
I mean, That wasn't the most important thing about her, not by miles, but back then it covered up practically everything else.
Any particular reason? Or just the way she was?
Partly just the way she was, and being that age. But I think mostly it was because of her mother.
Yeah,
what was she like?
This is what I mean about Steve being good with witnesses. The way he's leaning forward on the sofa, the tilt of his head, the note in his voice. Even I could believe he's genuinely personally interested.
She was messed up, Lucy says. Mrs. Murray, not Ash. Like, properly messed up. She should have been in therapy or on medication, or both.
Steve nods away.
What kind of messed up?
Ash said she used to be fine, back before we knew each other. But when Ash was almost 10, her dad walked out on them.
Lucy should be relaxing now that we've moved away from the murder and the hash and whatever she's hiding. But her fingers are still rigid on her smoke and her feet are still braced on the paint-splattered floorboards like she might need to run any minute.
They never knew why, exactly. He didn't say, just gone.
And that wrecked Mrs. Murray's head. She never got over it. She just started going downhill and couldn't stop.
Ash said she was ashamed. She felt like it had to have been her fault.
That twist to Lucy's mouth again, through her cigarette. But this time the warmth isn't there.
That generation, you know. Everything was the woman's fault somehow. And if you didn't get how, then you probably needed to pray harder.
So Ash's mum basically cut herself off from everyone. She still went to the shops and to mass, but that was it. So by the time we met, Ash had had 2 years where she spent most of her life stuck in the house. Just her and her mum and the telly. She's an only child. I never even wanted to go over there because her mum creeped me out so much. You'd hear her crying in the bedroom. Or else you'd go into the kitchen and she'd just be standing there, staring at a spoon while something went up in smoke on the cooker. And the curtains were always closed in case someone saw her through a window and, I don't know, thought bad things about her. And Aisling had to live there.
Steve's hit the go button.
Lucy's talking faster. She's not going to stop till we stop her, or till she crashes.
There was small stuff too. Like, since her mum didn't go out and they didn't have a lot of money, Ash's clothes were always wrong. She never had whatever everyone else in school was wearing. It was always charity shop crap that was 2 years out of date and didn't suit her. I used to lend her stuff, but we were different sizes. That was another reason Aisling was insecure. She was always, not fat, but a bit overweight. And my mum bought her stuff sometimes. But there's four of us, so there was a limit to what you could do, you know? It doesn't sound like a big deal, but when you're 12 and everyone already knows that your dad's left and your mum's gone off the rails, the last thing you need is to look like some weirdo.
This is the stuff Steve likes, and the stuff I'm wary of. He thinks it gives us an insight into the victim. Me, I think about those filters. I already know Lucy's got at least one agenda that we haven't pinned down.
The Aisling we're getting here is totally in Lucy's hands. She can do whatever she wants with her.
I say, this is going to sound blunt, Lucy, and I'm sorry about that. But I'm not getting why you two are friends. I'm trying to see it. But I can't put my finger on a single thing you've had in common.
What made it work?
I guess you had to be there. Lucy half smiles, not at me, at whatever she's seeing.
We did have stuff in common.
I wasn't having that great time in school either. I wasn't an outcast or anything, but I was always into carpentry and electrics, so the Balsamers gave me shite about that and called me a dyke. And the people who wanted to get in with them did it too. and it wasn't some major torture thing, but overall, school mostly sucked. But Ash, right? She thought I was great for the exact same things that everyone else was slagging me about. She thought I was totally amazing, like some kind of heroine, just because I told the other girls to fuck off and did what I wanted, even though they didn't like it. Ash thought that was the coolest thing ever. The smile spasms into something wretched. She takes the drag off her smoke to force it back under control. And yeah, at first partly I was hanging out with her because I liked her, thinking I was amazing. But after the first while, it was because I liked her. People thought she was thick, but that was just because of what I told you. How she was unsure. It made her seem like she wasn't keeping up. She wasn't thick at all. She was actually really perceptive. Steve is nodding along, all enthralled. I'm interested too, but not like that. Lucy wants us to know Aisling, or at least her version of Aisling. Wants it badly. Sometimes we get that. The friends and family want to shove a holy innocent in our faces, so we won't think this was all the Vic's fault. Usually they do it when they think it was at least partly the Vic's fault. Aisling shagging a married man might be enough to do that for Lucy. Or there might be more. And she could make even shit things funny. Like, I'd have some bitch off with some cow in our class, and afterwards I'd be all pissed off and adrenaline-y like, who does that geebag think she is? I should have punched her face in. And Ash would start giggling, and I'd be like, what? It's not funny. All ready to go off on her, but she'd go, you're brilliant. Like this little furious cat chasing away a horrible dirty hyena. And she'd do an imitation of me jumping up and down, trying to punch something way above my head. And she'd be like, I thought she was going to run for it. She'd be hiding in a corner screaming for help while you bit the ankles off her. Everyone would be crowding around, chanting your name. And all of a sudden, I'd be laughing too. And the whole thing wouldn't feel like a big deal anymore. I wouldn't feel like such a big deal. Lucy laughs, but there's a stretched sound to it, like straining against the solid weight of pain, dragging downwards. That was Ash. She made things better. Maybe because she'd had so much practice with her mum, trying to make their life even bearable for both of them. I don't know. But even when she couldn't make things better for herself, she made them better for other people. Please, I don't know where else to... That woman was still the 12-year-old that Lucy's describing. Chubby, insecure, clothes that wouldn't suit anyone, and definitely didn't suit her. The dead woman was a whole different story. I say, things got better for her too, though. She grew into her looks, got a bit of style, a bit of confidence, yeah? Lucy grinds out her smoke, picks up her glass but doesn't drink. Now that we've moved back to the present, the carefulness is creeping back in. She says, not as soon as she should have. Even after we left school, she stayed living at home. She felt like she couldn't leave her mother. And even though I thought her staying was a terrible idea, I could see her point. Without Aisling there, probably her mum would have killed herself inside a few weeks. So right up until a few years ago, Ash was going home to that house every night. Just like when we were kids. It kept her. She turns the glass between her hands, watching the light move on the surface of the water. Like it kept her from growing up. She had a job, but it was the same one she'd had since we left school. She was the receptionist at this place that sells toilet roll and hand soap to businesses, which would have been fine, except it wasn't what she wanted to do. She didn't have a clue what she wanted. She'd never had a chance to think about it. I was scared for her, You know, I could see us being 30, 40, and Ash still doing this job she'd wandered into and going straight home to look after her mum. And her whole life just... Lucy snaps her fingers, hand lifting through a patch of pale sun. Gone. And she could see it too. She just didn't know how to do anything about it. So what changed? Steve asks. Mrs. Murray died.